How do you respond to good news? We were in London over the Christmas break, and we walked past the bridge where I proposed to Roz on January the 18th, 2003. And I was telling the boys, and they were asking, what happened, Dad? Did you get down on one knee? Yes. Did people notice? Yeah, I think some tourists even took some pictures of us. And then we walked past the park where Roz and I had stopped to call our families. And I can still recall Roz calling her parents, her sister, her aunt, the excitement, the joy. And then I called my parents and similar joy and excitement. Then we arranged for our parents to get together that afternoon so we could all celebrate together. When there is good news, truly good news, it causes a response. You can't just go, that's nice. It's truly good news. If it's truly good news to your ears, then it does something inside of you. It stirs emotions that's then seen in our response, in how we then work that out. You can't just go, that's lovely. And move on. Not if it's truly good news. You share it. You tell everyone. It shapes what you do. And friends, the gospel, the good news of Jesus, really is good news for us. It's the first point this morning. Wake up. The gospel really is good news for us. That's what this verse declares, verse 7. See how beautiful on the mountain are the feet of those who bring good news, who proclaim peace, who bring good tidings, good times, who proclaim salvation. And the peace being spoken of here is not a peace on earth between nations, but peace between man and God. It's to be reconciled to Him. The good tidings, the good times are speaking of the experience of living under God's blessing and not under His curse. The salvation is not from enemies, but from judgment, but from God's wrath. And you see, to grasp why this is therefore good news, one has to understand the context that these words are initially spoken to Israel in. So here it is. They're the people of God. The people God had rescued from Egypt and from slavery and made His own. He'd given them a land. He had dwelt in the midst of them in His temple. He had given them His gracious, life-giving words, His law, that they might know how to live before a holy God. He'd given them a king to rule over them and care for them. He had committed Himself personally to them in covenant, in promise. He had spoken of them as His daughter, His bride, His beloved. He loved them. He cherished them. And they had rejected Him, spurned His love, turned to other gods and idols and nations. Just flip back to Isaiah chapter 1. So Isaiah chapter 1 gives us a picture of this. See, have a look at 1 verse 4. Woe to the sinful nation, a people whose guilt is great, a brood of evildoers, children given to corruption. They have forsaken the Lord. They have spurned the Holy One of Israel and turned their backs on Him. Do you see what they're saying? See how it's rejected Him and spurned Him and hurt God in that sense. And then it goes on, 1 verse 13, we learn they bring meaningless offerings. They hold worthless assemblies and festivals. They do not love God. Their hands, we're told, are full of blood, verse 15. They're unclean. If you flick over to verse 21, you see that Jerusalem is spoken of as a prostitute, unfaithful. The rulers, Verse 23, as rebels who partner with thieves, who love bribes and chase after gifts, who do not defend the cause of the fatherless. Their actions are sinful and evil. They treat a holy, loving God wickedly. And God's response to their sin and to their wickedness is one of righteous judgment, both as their creator, but also as the one who has committed to them in relationship. He promised he would discipline them if they rebelled. And so we read chapter 1, verse 24. Therefore, the Lord Almighty, the Mighty One of Israel declares, I will vent my wrath on my foes and avenge myself on my enemies. I will turn my hand against you. I will thoroughly purge away your dross and remove all your impurities. He's going to judge them for their wickedness, but then note what he promises next. I will restore your leaders as in days of old, your rulers as at the beginning. Afterwards, you will be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. See what God's promising? Judgment. But through that judgment, he'll purify them and reestablish them as his people. And then Isaiah chapter 2 to 39 kind of details much of this judgment. And it will be ultimately felt and seen in Israel being removed from the land and taken into exile in Babylon. And then from chapter 40 onwards of Isaiah, God begins to promise and speak of how he will bring them back, how he will restore them. And Isaiah 52 verse 7 is the point when Israel dawns. The judgment has passed and peace and reconciliation with God is real. And the good times of blessing, not curse, are here. And salvation and not judgment has come. And God has kind of been declaring this over and over from chapter 40 right through to 51. But Israel has not believed it. They've just not grasped it. So you go back to 51 verse 1 with me. It's God speaking to them. He says, listen to me. You who pursue righteousness, who seek the Lord. Look what I've done in the past, he says, verse 2. Verse 3, 51, therefore surely I will comfort Zion and will look with compassion on her and make her deserts like Eden and her wastelands like the garden of the Lord, and joy and gladness will be found in her. You see, the restoration promise is coming after the judgment of chapters 2 to 39. He says, verse 4, listen to me, my people. Verse 5, my salvation is on the way. Verse 6, lift your eyes. My salvation will last forever. My righteousness will never fail. Verse 7, hear me. But then look at verse 9. Israel now calls on God to act. Awake, awake, arm of the Lord. Clothe yourself with strength. Wake up. As if somehow God is asleep. As if somehow he's not hearing them, or he's not acting, or not in action in any way. They've not quite listened to what he's been saying and promising that he is doing. They're not quite believed. It's a bit like, you know, when you give a clear command to your kids, and for all intents and purposes, they look like they've heard you. They've nodded, good eye contact, it's all gone well. And then 5 minutes later, you find them doing the very thing that you've just commanded them not to. And you say to them, did you not hear? No, well, what did you say? It's your fault, you didn't tell me, I did tell you. And carries on. It's a bit like Isaiah, Israel here. God's been telling them over and over, he's going to save them, he's going to do this. And then they say, wake up, as if he's asleep. Come and save us like you did in the past, that, you know, that we might return, O Zion, with gladness and joy, verse 11. And here they are, they're fearing. Men and the armies, as they sit in Babylon, that's where it's spoken of, and they're looking to God to act, forgetting that he is acting and working. And look how God responds, verse 12. I am he who comforts you. You don't fear men. Don't fear those who hold you captive. Verse 13, all things are under my control. Verse 14, I will liberate you and feed you. Verse 15, for I am the one who rules the uncontrollable seas and is the Lord of the host of heavens, and I am the Almighty. And I am the one, verse 16, who reveals himself to his people in his word and brings them into personal relationship and declaring them to be my people. I don't need to be woken up. I'm already active. I'm already working for you. No, it's you that needs to wake up, verse 17. It's you who needs to be aroused to faith. It's you who needs to wake up and recognize the new day of restoration is dawning after the long night of discipline and punishment. And verses 18 to 23 then kind of emphasize this. They keep saying, look, the fury of God's righteous anger has been drunk in the experience of the exile. That same cup of judgment is now removed. And it's become, instead, the experience of your tormentors. His anger reduced Jerusalem to hopelessness. But while she slept, the cup has been removed. The wrath is over. And Israel needs to wake up to the reality of what God has done. And 52 verse 1. Awake, not just to simply realize the passing of God's anger, but to wake to assume their new role as God's holy city. So he says, put on your garments of splendor, Jerusalem, the holy city. The defilement, verse 1, the dust, the slavery, verses 2 to 3, the oppression, verse 4, the mocking, verse 5, the opposition, verse 6, has been gone. It's been removed. Nothing more to fear. Verse 7, how beautiful then. On the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news. Who proclaim this peace, that reconciliation with God is back. And good tidings, Jerusalem is splendid once more, and blessing, not curse, is experienced again, and salvation has come and not judgment. It's good news. And here's the thing, Israel must believe it. And they must live it. Be who God has made them to be. They must awake to the reality. It really is good news. Judgment has been dealt with. Your sin has been dealt with. You can have peace and good tidings and salvation. The sin as described in chapter 1 has been punished. The dross removed. The city that was described as a prostitute and unfaithful is now the holy and splendid city. The people who opposed and hated and offered meaningless sacrifices are now called righteous. My people once more. It really is good news. And of course for us, this side of the cross, we see how this good news is ultimately fulfilled in Jesus, in his coming. In fact, he's described at the end of chapter 52 in verse 53. See, he is the servant, isn't he? Have a look. He is a servant who is rejected, who's despised, who bore our suffering, who was punished, who was afflicted by God, who was pierced for our transgressions, who was crushed for our iniquities. See that verse 4? Verse 5, verse 6, we all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. On the cross, that's exactly what happened, isn't it? That we might not be rejected or despised or cut off, judged, but rather that we might be saved, that we might have peace, that we might be reconciled in relationship with God, that we might experience good tidings, blessings rather than curse, delighting and enjoying him, that we might have salvation rather than judgment, that we might look forward to the new Jerusalem, not an eternity without him. It really is good news. And Israel says, wake up to the reality. Wake up to that good news. But I fear we're much like the Israelites who first heard Isaiah preach. We don't really believe it's good news. We know it in our heads. I mean, academically, as it were. But we don't really believe it. We don't functionally believe it in the sense that it works itself out in our lives. Some of us think we're just too bad. God can forgive others, but not me. My sin's too bad. I'm too wicked, too shameful. He couldn't possibly forgive me. Friend, there is no sin that he cannot forgive. Oh, but Mark, you don't know me. If you knew, you would think the same. My sexual past, my porn addiction, my anger, my hatred, my past relationships, my financial mistakes, my gambling, my drinking, my pride, my lust, my lying, my cheating, my adultery. No, he can't forgive me. Yes, he can. Yes, he can. The Gospels are just full of Jesus meeting and calling people just like you and me. I mean, think about Jesus by the well in John chapter 4. You know, speaking with a woman who's had multiple relationships. She's currently with a man who's not even her husband. She's drawing water in the heat of the day because of the shame of her actions. And Jesus meets with her. She comes to see who he is and the good news that he brings. Or the sinful woman in Luke 7. I mean, would you want to be known throughout history as the sinful woman or man? And Simon the Pharisee, whose house Jesus is at and who this woman has come. And she's weeping over Jesus' feet. And Simon the Pharisee looks at her and he says, oh, if this man, Jesus, was a prophet, he would know who's touching him. He would know what kind of woman she is. If she's a sinner, I mean, likely a prostitute. And what are Jesus' final words to her? Your sins are forgiven. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace. You're reconciled with God. You're restored once more. It really is good news. It really is good news for all. There is no sin that cannot be forgiven. You wake up. Believe. Have your faith aroused. Be who you're called to be. By trusting in Jesus, there is no sin that cannot be forgiven. It really is good news. Others of us, though, I would suggest many of us have the opposite problem. We've stopped believing it's good news or truly seeing it as good news because we started to think actually we're good enough. We're not that sinful. We're more like the Pharisee in Luke chapter 18. You know, the one who stands before God with the sin inside him and he gives thanks for all the ways in that he is righteous and how good he is and what he's done. Now, I know, we'd never declare that or would do that because we know that would be the wrong thing to do and we'd never utter those words or even dare think those words that were that good. But our actions reveal different. See, we're not moved by the good news. Oh, we're glad our sins are forgiven and we're glad we're going to heaven. But we're not living as if it really is good news. You can see it in our prayers. They become perfunctory. You just go through the motions. No kind of awe at the sense that we're reconciled or in relationship with God and who we call our Father in heaven and that we've been able to do so because of Jesus. There's no desire to want to pray or to speak with him. You can see it in how one sings. Not with heartfelt praise. Again, we're going through the motions. We're opening our mouths, but the sense of connection of what we're singing and who we're singing it to and why we're singing it and not really stirring us or moving us. Joy of our salvation's gone. You see it in how one serves. Again, we know we need to serve, so we do. But we do it with grumbling. We moan, we murmur. I've got to do it. I sign up to a rota. And that's it done for this week, this month. You know, we're doing our bit. But I ain't going to do any more. What do you mean? I've done an hour, I've done 2 hours. I'm not doing any more this week. What do you mean I've got to carry on and stay on a little bit more? It's not from a heart that's moved by the good news, that just delights to serve because of what Christ has done for me. We don't share the good news. I mean, we're happy to say we're Christian. Do you go to church? Of course I go to church. Are you a Christian? Oh, yeah, I'm a Christian. But I don't speak about Jesus. I don't share the good news from a heart that is so overwhelmed by what Christ has done. I'm just going through the motions. I'm just like the Israelites in chapter 1, who these worthless festivals and meaningless sacrifices. I'm just going through the motions. Because what's happened? I've stopped believing it's good news. I've stopped being amazed at what Jesus has done and his love for me, that it so drives me to outflowing of love and praise and service and evangelism. I think about the sinful woman. You know, she weeps at Jesus' feet. She wets his feet with her tears. She wipes them with her hair. She kisses them and pours perfume onto them. And sadly, I'm more like the Pharisee. I do the religious deeds. I attend church. I pray. I read the Bible. It's not connecting. It's not flowing out into every area of my life. And what does Jesus say to Simon? Tells him a story. Two people owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed 500 denarii, the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he forgave the debts of both. Which of them loved him more, Simon? The one with the bigger debt. See, the problem is I behave like my debt is 50 rather than 500. And the reality is my debt is like the 500. And I need to wake up and remember, actually, I am wicked. And I am sinful. And I am just like the Israelites described in chapter 1. So that I'll be amazed once more at the cross and what Christ has done. Because, friends, this really is good news. I can have peace with God. I can have good tidings, blessing, not curses. It's salvation, not judgment. It really is good news. I just finished reading a book on Luther and his counseling. How he used to care for people. Here was a man who believed it was really good news. He spoke of it in every correspondence. Every speaking to someone, he would point them to the good news of the gospel. Here was a man who knew his debt and his sin, and he knew he could do nothing about it. He'd tried. You know, he'd whipped himself, literally. You know, he'd confessed every sin he could possibly think of. He'd done all he could to try and make himself right with God. He found he could do nothing. And he reads Romans and Galatians and he discovers the good news of Jesus. And he found it good news indeed. And he spoke of it and counseled it and it shaped and it touched everything he did. Friends, we need to wake up to the reality of what Christ has done for us. We need to wake up to the work of God in our lives. We need to wake up and have our faith aroused to see the good news of what it truly is. We need to wake up and start living as those who have heard and experienced such good news. It really is good news for us. Lord, help us in this year to wake up to see our sin for what it is, that we might wake to see the good news of Jesus for what it truly is, that it might shape our prayers, our praise, our service, our evangelism in the year ahead. It really is good news. And then secondly, wake up, our God really is reigning. And you'll be pleased to know that this sermon is utterly not balanced at all. And the second and third points are much shorter than the first. So you wake up. Our God really is reigning. See verse 7? The feet that bring the good news, who proclaim the peace, the good tidings and salvation, also declare to Zion, to God's people, your God reigns. Now why does Isaiah declare that? Because the Israelites have stopped believing God was on his throne. It's why over and over in the section from chapter 40, we're reminded God is in sovereign control. None of the events that happened to Israel, the exile, happened by random chance or because the gods of the nations that took them into exile were somehow stronger and bigger than their God. No. God's in control. He's reigning. I mean, look back at chapter 40 with me. Just flick back there. One of my favorite passages. As God promises to bring them back from exile, verses 3 to 5. Look what is then declared from verse 9 onwards. You who bring good news to Zion, go up on a high mountain. You who bring good news to Jerusalem, verse 9. Lift up your voice with a shout. Lift it up. Do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. Verse 10, see the sovereign Lord comes with power. He rules with a mighty arm, that we are reminded of who he is, you see. And then look, verse 12. He has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or with the breadth of his hand marked off the heavens, or weighed the mountains. Who can fathom the Spirit of the Lord? Verse 15, surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. Verse 18, with whom then will you compare God? To what image will you liken him? As for an idol, verse 19, a metal worker casts it, a goldsmith overlays it with gold, and a fashion silver chains for it. Fashion silver chains for it. Verse 21, do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood? Since the earth was founded, verse 22, he sits enthroned above the circle of the earth. And its people are like grasshoppers. And he stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. Verse 25, of to whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal, says the Holy One. God really is reigning. And yet the Israelites forget it. They stop believing it, so that when God is promising this return to Zion and restoration, what do they say in 51 verse 9 as we saw? They call him to awake as if he was asleep. As if he's not reigning or working out his purposes. And Isaiah declares, verse 52, verse 7, no, your God reigns. Do you see what Isaiah is saying to them? There is no other gods. There's nothing to fear. He's in control of all events. He is working out his purposes. He is active, awake. He's ruling. And as such, he can and he will fulfill what he's promised. He will bring peace and good tidings and salvation. He will transform them and restore them and save them. And Isaiah goes on, 52 verse 8, he says that there will be a day when they will see it with their own eyes. And so many of them did. They saw the return from exile to Babylon. Years later, many of that later generations would see the Messiah arrive and Jesus is coming. And then verse 10. There will be a day when all will see his salvation. The Lord will lay bare his holy arm in the sight of all nations, and all the ends of the earth will see the salvation of our God. There will be a day when all will see what he has done. He has not gone to sleep. He's not clocked off. There's no other force or idol or God who reigns. He reigns. Your God reigns. And yet there are times, aren't there? Like Israel, I'm tempted to forget God reigns. You know, we hear the news, increased liberalism, secularism, Christianity on the down, people increasingly hostile to the gospel. And we're tempted to think like the Israelites, God's gone to sleep. You know, where is he? Wake up. Do something. I want to give up or retreat into my holy huddle. And Isaiah says, no, wake up. Believe your God reigns. He's working out his purposes and his plans. He's allowed these things for a reason and for his purposes and for the good of his people and the glory of the Lord Jesus, just as he did with Israel. You see, he will and is saving, transforming, bringing people into his kingdom. Even now, he will do what he has promised. See, it's all too easy to look around and feel a little sorry for ourselves as Christians. It's people so anxious and so hard, and it's getting harder. And yes, that all may be true, but our God reigns. And sometimes we just need to lift our eyes to what he is doing. If I was to say to you, what is the fastest growing evangelical church in the world? Anyone guess? This is time for interaction. Fastest growing church, in evangelical church in the world right now. Where's that? China? Any other guesses? Sorry? North Korea? Iran. The fastest growing evangelical church in the world is Iran. There were less than 500 known Christians in the late 70s. It's now estimated to be closer to 1 million. In one of the hardest opposed nations in the world, our God reigns. Do you want to know the second fastest evangelical church in the world? Tough, I'm going to tell you. Afghanistan. you know why? Because the Iranians and the Afghans share a similar language, and the Iranians are going and proclaiming the gospel to the Afghans. See, don't be intimidated by the world, by what it says, by the news, by our friends and their opinions. Our God reigns. And we hear that and we go, yeah, no, we know that, Mark. That's great. We love that. Iran, Afghanistan, that's so exciting. And then it comes to telling my family and my friends. And some of you are sitting there thinking right now, but their hearts are too hard. My husband, my wife, my daughter, my son, my mother, my father, my family, my friends. They'll never believe, Mark. They'll never change. Their hearts are too hard. Our God reigns. He can transform the hardest of hearts. He transformed yours. He can move a culture. He can redeem a nation. He can change a town. He can bring peace and good tidings and salvation to your friends and your family. Don't give up. Your God reigns. It really is good news. And so Isaiah says this. Be beautiful feet. Go be beautiful feet. See, when Paul quotes Isaiah 52, verse 7 in Romans 10, he does so in the context of Israel hearing the gospel, hearing it preached. And so he writes, Romans 10, 14, how then can they call on the one they've not believed in? How can they believe in the one of whom they've not heard? How can they hear without someone preaching to them? And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. Now, Paul's realistic. He goes on to say, not all Israelites believe, but how will any believe if they've not heard the good news of Jesus? You see, if we really believe it's good news and our God reigns, then we'll get on with what he's called us to do. We'll go and be the beautiful feet. We'll go and make disciples of this world because we'll want to tell and share the good news. And Ros and I couldn't wait to share the good news of our engagement. How much more so? The news that there is a way for people to have peace with God, to be saved and to be blessed, not cursed. And sometimes we get ourselves all riled up by the moral issues of the day. You know, shout at the radio because another MP's announced another anti-God, anti-Bible, anti-moral law kind of thing. And we become so focused on wanting the morality of our nation better and that people do marriage right, etc. And of course, they're all good and right. But we forget that what people need is not better morals or a better standard of living. But ultimately what they need is to hear the good news of Jesus. Ultimately what the world needs us to be is not moral policemen. What your family and friends need us to be is beautiful feet. Now feet are probably one of the least attractive parts of the body. I always remember growing up and my mum hates feet, hates them. Loves baby's feet, hates any other feet. Now granted, she had two stinky boys and their feet are not great, especially when one's suffering with athlete's foot. I don't anymore. So they're not beautiful in any stretch of the imagination. But here, we're told the feet that bring good news to Jesus are truly beautiful. That there's a dignity to it. There's a joy to it. There's a glory. There's a wonder to it. See, we so often think, don't we? Oh, sharing the good news is the hardest, worst thing we have to do. And Isaiah says, no, it's beautiful. It even transforms feet into a beauty. Who will you be beautiful feet to this year? In your family, in your workplace, in your neighborhood? We even think about moving. Going to a place where there is no gospel witness, maybe in this land, maybe a town in our land, maybe abroad, to a nation where there is no gospel or little gospel content. Will you be beautiful feet? And you only will be if you believe that the gospel really is good news for us and that our God really is reigning and working out his purposes. And if you don't believe that, then wake up. Believe. Resolve this year to do so that it might transform your prayer life and your service and your evangelism, that you'll be driven by a great love like the sinful woman because it really is good news and our God really is reigning. So be beautiful feet. take a moment as the band come on up. And we sing Awake, Awake, O Zion in a minute. Think about how you're going to be beautiful feet. Think about how maybe you're not quite believing the good news. Maybe you stop believing that your God reigns. Every time you come into church this year and you see the verse up there, think to yourself, ask yourself the question, am I still believing this really is good news? Am I still believing that my God reigns? Am I still seeking to be beautiful feet? Every time you come to church this year and you see that verse, or you see it on your mantelpiece or in the bookmark, am I still believing this really is good news? That our God reigns. Am I being beautiful feet? Let's stand and sing.